This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 348, Whistle While You Walk. Hello, everybody. Welcome again to GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about games and work and tech and everything new that's been talked about on the internet. My name's Andy Piper. I'm based in London and coming to you from a small recording studio in my front bedroom. And I'm joined this week by my good friend, Mr. Michael Rowe. How are things, Michael?
Things are well, Andy. Thank you. I am glad to see your smiling face and hear your dulcet tones as we get into another exciting episode of GamesAtWork.biz. We were talking last week about Minecraft. And all kinds of goodness about that.
Something to do with blocks. Oh, that was another thing. That
blocks and
week.
Heights and lows and right. And what is ground? What is ground level?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we had a whole discussion on, you know, that ground level was relative based off of in the old design. It was relative. I think you could build landscapes and that would give you a level of levelness, but zero is still always zero, right?
Right. And so the news was that they were about to expand that, right? So they literally
to go down to minus something,
down further and up further. So they were kind of shifting everything, yes, and adding like whole new dimensions to the game.
But it was on top of the landscape. So if the landscape curved up and had a hill, zero is the hill,
kind of,
and you could go down into the hill or above. And before, you couldn't. You actually had to create a hill in order to build something below.
Right.
Or something like that.
Something like that.
Yes. Something like that.
We sound like experts and pros about this right now. Our listeners are
People are just rapt with the attention saying, wow, tell us more about Minecraft, please. Right. What about version 1.18?
What about version 1.18? Caves and cliffs.
You found an interesting article about massive new mountains and caves.
Yeah, I mean, we've been expecting this because we talked about it last week and we were marveling at the expansion, but it's really interesting to see the outcome of what is potentially otherwise seen as a small technical change or a technical change. But there's a really nice piece on PC Gamer that caught my attention. It's clickbait in the sense that the headline caught my attention, but it's a really nice
mission accomplished.
It's a really nice piece. So the title by Lauren Morton is Minecraft 1.18 finally resurrects the experimental feel I loved 11 years ago. Now that was enough to drag me right into the article and start poking around and get interested. And my friend Matt saw me and us tweeting about Minecraft and in fact last week's show and asked me if I'd got back into it to try this out. So the interesting thing here is really the sense of scale, the fact that because of the size of this change, even though it's a technical change, it really changes the feel of the game and gives you a lot more of the sort of sense of wonder. The fact that, you know, the landscapes now can have these gigantic mountains and cliffs and then also having these really cavernous caves. The one thing that I'm sad about, I remember several years ago we were talking about this change, and I think it would have always been an absolutely foundational change had they ever introduced it, but they ended up not doing it, which was the ray tracing stuff. There were rumors, they experimented with and really making everything look almost a lot more realistic, even though it was still sort of block-based architecture. And I was interested when that whole thing, as far as I understand it, got cancelled and never came out. But I mean, it still looks quite amazing. I believe another thing I read this week was that people have been struggling because I think they've changed the Java launcher. So some people were finding problems getting the game to launch once the update came out. But it's enough to certainly make me go and have another play and explore and try things out. It's interesting now that it's multi-platform that I don't really know where to start again. Which platform to
it's funny you're talking about Java launchers, and I actually was just working on a problem trying to set up remote server debugging on a Java application running on a web server from an Eclipse environment, and dealing with lots of fun there. And of course, the instructions that I was able to find were all about Tomcat, but that, of course, was not the server that I was running. So it's like I fully understand the problem with Java launch options being problematic.
Yeah, and most games.
How timely of you to mention that.
Most games players don't want to worry about like those kind of parameters and stuff. Although, if you're
no, not at all.
If you are a user of the Java version, then that's the one that's always been hackable and like enables you to mod the game in a lot more detail and, you know, play around with it and do things like integrating, you know, hardware in the real world into the virtual world and things like that, which has always been very cool.
Speaking of crossing the boundary between like the real and the virtual world, there was an interesting article this week about Google doing some 3D telepresence experimentation. And I really thought it was kind of interesting how this is being positioned. I haven't had a chance to really dig deep into the technology yet, right?
Okay.
And the likelihood is I won't have time to. because, you know, it starts off saying, you know, we're not just having someone talk to a screen, right? But it's a portal into another world. I'm like, well, screens are kind of a portal into another world.
This is a story on The Verge, came out just a day or so ago, about something called Project Starline, which is an experiment at Google. And the premise here is that you end up with something like almost a virtual window that you look through to somebody who is rendered three-dimensionally. So it's so realistic. So you mentioned the sort of digging into the technology. Give you a quick rundown of it. You've got a 65-inch 8K display.
Well, don't we all have those sitting around?
Absolutely. Surrounded by multiple capture pods that capture both the color and the depth of the person. So you've got 3D image capture on the one side. Then there's
and you have fantastic lighting, right? Because lighting is critical in this too, right? So you got an appropriate backlight, you've got the display light coming on. So then you get the shadows in order to get the really dimensional aspect.
So then the video presentation from Google talks about, you know, the breakthroughs here. So the ability to capture in 3D, then pipe the content in real time. So you've got a lot of data when you're doing that in real time with, you know, three-dimensionally captured objects as video, essentially. And then obviously the ability to then display that in such a way through a 3D screen that it appears realistic. You know, it appears, as I say, like almost like a piece of glass you could reach through to touch a three-dimensional thing. So the other side of it...
They're using what? Four high-end NVIDIA cards?
Right, that's exactly what I was getting onto, right? So you know, if you think the chip shortage is bad now and you've been trying to get, you know, RTX cards for the last 12 months, then good luck. Because not only are we using them for cryptocurrency mining, we're going to use them for, like, you know, multiple of them for rendering this level of stuff. Now, we've talked about this multiple times before. This stuff becomes more... available and natural, and you know they've now essentially got a Microsoft Kinect built into the top of every iPhone. But there's still going to be a pretty steep curve.
It's crazy, a lot of tech, but it looks fantastic. I mean, it does look the way they shot it, right? It does look like it's a pane of glass, and there's a person on each side, and you're just looking at each other through that. Right. I mean, so.
Well, I mean, look, Google's putting it into their offices. So lucky if you go for a meeting there to do a virtual call.
Well, no, you don't want to go for a meeting there because you want to experience it. If you go there, then you're physically together.
Yeah.
Unless you go to two different offices. But Point well taken. And it's going to get cheaper. It's going to the technology is going to get more available. But at the same time, and this is, I'm not going to use the fallacy, but this is the fallacy of that thought is, yes, the tech gets cheaper and more available, mm-hmm. but we continue to push the capabilities higher and higher too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to be on the bleeding edge, it's always expensive and low and not very accessible. So all the cool things that we talk about tend to be on the bleeding edge, which is so exciting, but not yet available for the average person.
Right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the average person, we got an article this week. Those segues are just incredible, aren't they?
almost professional.
Yeah. There was a game being played in one of the London boroughs to try to convince people to use less cars and less transit,
right?
And to use human powered transit like bikes and walking, etc.
Right.
You were going through this earlier, and,
yeah,
and kind of given a perspective of what you thought about it. So
I mean, so it's important to mention, given where we are in history, that this happened a couple of years ago. So this is a write-up of the exercise that happened back in 2019. Mm-hmm. So we're in December 2021, looking at something, results from an experiment that was run.
It takes a while to consolidate the data.
Of course,
do the analysis.
Of course, I'm just making the point that, you know, at the moment, ideally, don't go out too much anyway. But there was a couple of goals here, right? So there was a couple of goals. One was to improve fitness and health and encourage people to get out and move around, and also by taking people off of the mass transit systems to reduce congestion, reduce pollution, and all those kinds of things. So
both noise pollution as well as actual pollution,
right?
Like, so the environmental pollution.
So the way that they did this was to gamify the whole process. So they put these what they call beat boxes onto street furniture, so, you know, lampposts and so on, and then folks would be asked to tap onto those things as they moved around, so that they were physically there. So it's not just something that you can fake by, you know, faking a GPS signal, for example. You're actually physically tapping in and out of these boxes to show that you'd been there. And it's interesting, I found, and I suspected it when I heard about it, that it was largely driven by young people or people with youngsters who got really into the activity and wanting to, mm-hmm. you know, move around, learn about their environment more, and obviously, you know, tap in and make sure that they were getting their parents to tap in on these things. It's a really interesting way of gamifying the process. There was a system or a website, and also there was the other sort of carrot here was that there was, you know, an effort to raise money for charity. So people felt a bit more engaged.
I did find it somewhat interesting and this is where gamification methods can be gamed, right? The majority of the effort, over half, was during the times of 8 and 9 a.m. and 3 and 4 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
about the time that people go to school and come home from school.
Right.
Which means they could take the bus or they could walk, right?
Right.
And the question is, and this, I don't know if they captured this. They captured the results of the number of people who did it, the distance that they traveled. But is that of the 96,849 miles traveled by the 28,000+ people, how many of them would have traveled what percentage of that distance anyway, because they're walking back and forth to work or walking back and forth to school during those time periods?
There are numbers here as well, right? So this was during a fixed period game, which actually reached nearly 10% of the population of the borough, which is a decent number. Mm-hmm. But they measured 53% reduction in cars and vans on peak routes during those peak times. So that's a decent number. You do have to ask.
So there is an impact there. You can correlate and make an assumption, mm-hmm. that game had a causation effect to this correlation of the reduction in vehicles on the road during these time periods.
Yeah. And I mean, I haven't dug into the all of the detail here, and there's reference to creating sort of teams as part of this as well. So there was also sort of a social cohesion element to it from the implication is anyway. I haven't dug into that in too much detail, but I enjoy this. It's a nice demonstration that gamification can work in certain contexts, and maybe in this case, obviously, particularly using it as an experiment to demonstrate something rather than it being some kind of massive ongoing process that people would lose interest in over time.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's interesting the fact that there are some correlations that could imply causation is good. And the thing that I was thinking about is, you know, as you're walking down the street and you cross the street and you watch like old TV shows from the 50s, what did the one person used to have who would stand in the middle of the street and kind of hold up their arm and say, you can't walk. And then they would do something and have the other people come across. Didn't they like blow a whistle of some sort to kind of direct the traffic?
I wondered how you were going to do that, Link. I was going to say, you know what I would like? I would just like a massive electric vehicle to drive around instead of this. Maybe one that was in the shape of a whistle.
Or you could use the whistle to direct the traffic because cut down all the stuff.
Well, I personally don't need a whistle, but if I did need a whistle, I would not be buying a Tesla cyber whistle.
You know, this. I saw this article, and then we also passed it around. So I think we all saw the article roughly at some same time this week, and the whole point was, oh, you know, after that silly $20 cloth, here's a $50 whistle, and I took it differently, right? I'm looking at this saying, okay, yeah, there's a profit on this whistle, but it is made from steel. If I remember correctly, right? It's machined, it's polished, so there's labor costs or manufacturing costs. The design probably had the design element because they had to render the Cybertruck into whistle form. and so is $50 just completely unreasonable for a cyber whistle?
I wouldn't know because I can't buy one, so I can't test it out because they've sold out. It does also feature an integrated attachment feature for added versatility.
Presumably, you need that added versatility.
Presumably, it's got a loop that you can put a bit of cord
a loop
through.
That hooks on your key ring.
Wow.
I think they would probably give you one of these when you bought the Cybertruck.
It's funny, though, because this is an article that we saw, I think all of us saw on Cult of Mac, all three of us hosts saw on Cult of Mac. And it says that this implies that it's actually going to be worth a lot more than purchase price in the future. Some of the buyers have already listed theirs on eBay for more than double the original price. And I might just have a quick look on eBay whilst we're talking.
See what the current price is.
Current prices, especially with shipping to the UK. So let's see, Cyber Whistle. Tesla Limited Edition Cyber Whistle Replica. For £15.99, but a brand new real one is going for anywhere between sold out at £225, so that's what, about $250 for $250, something like that.
Round number.
They go down to as low as about £120 at the moment, so £115 maybe. But yeah, I mean,
and five times the original price
at least. But what's the Cyber Whistle Replica? That looks like a 3D print to me.
it's probably not made from medical grade stainless steel. Is there non-medical grade stainless steel? I assume there is.
This is indeed, it is indeed 3D printed. The replica one. In sort of by what looks like grey ABS filament. I could buy three. The price goes down if I buy three or more. So
well, of course, because you're saving the manufacturing.
I could buy
print all three of them at the same time. Why don't I buy the same build plate?
I could buy a pack of three for the or each of us hosts, and then we could all rock our cyber whistles on a future episode of this.
Yeah, show. And we could like whistle while we play games at work,
whilst we polish our Apple screens with our non-existent Apple gloss, because they've sold out as well.
So yeah. I still need to replace my 3D printer at some point in time, since it's been dead for a while. And then I could print the versatile attachment for maximum versatility.
Well, we're talking of three.
Yes.
to extend the very weak links in this episode of the show.
Well, you know, Web 3.0 is a set of links, linking technologies together.
See, exactly. It's all connected. It's all connected.
Have you watched any of the BBC show from Douglas Adams, Dirk Gently?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. It's finally been showing over here on one of the streaming services, so I've been watching it and laughing my... Yes, I love it. Everything's connected.
Yeah, Stephen Mangan is great. He's it's a good show. He was in a very good absurd abstract comedy, medical comedy called Greenwig originally, and then he's kind of gone on to do things like Dirk Gently. So he's a very good comic and comedian and actor. It's a fun show.
Anyway, but we digress.
We do, completely.
So this web, and so there's three of them, right?
Well, there's at least three versions. Our show and history together goes back to at least Web 2.0 days, in fact, pre-Web 2.0 days, when we started to talk about Web 2.0 as the new thing. And then Michael started to talk about Web 11.0 as the far future thing that he's already an expert in. but no, I mean, Web 3.0, I have had it in my mind that it has been debated what it means or could mean for some time. I always had thought of it as either a virtual world type space or some form of decentralization. And obviously with all the meta stuff happening, there's been speculation and conversation around that as well. But evidently, according to this story in Wired, and this is a piece of information I didn't have until I read this story, Gavin Wood actually sort of coined the term Web3 in 2014. So it has been something that's effectively defined and accepted for a while now around decentralization and as those technologies look like now, basing that on blockchain, so that central gatekeepers aren't possible and aren't... in charge of the web as such. And I was talking before we came on the show that I've started to look at things like, and I'm late in the game here because people are way ahead of us, or certainly way ahead of me in this. I started to look at things like the Web Monetization Initiative in the last few months, and getting more interested, generally speaking, in these technologies. Now, I know that things like Bitcoin have been through bubbles and continue to be super interesting. Other cryptocurrencies are getting a lot of attention as well. I actually, as a result, just to digress slightly, but talk about this in perhaps a bit more detail, from a payments perspective, something that happened to me this week was as a result of playing with web monetization. I also set up a new wallet on a system called Uphold, which is a secure wallet. And then my bank decided to suspend my bank account because I wanted to move some money to this other place. And evidently they didn't like that, or they thought it was a suspicious transaction of mine.
They don't want you to move your money.
So they suspended my account until I physically or verbally spoke to them. I couldn't do anything through any of the online or apps or services I had. Everything was locked until I
have to go into a branch, or you just had to call somebody?
I think that would have been the next step had we not been in the pandemic. I had to go through a lot of security questions, and I had to explain to this gentleman in no uncertain terms and in great detail just how much I knew and understood about what I was doing. I think that he made the point
probably
to
much
me
more
that,
than he understood and knew about what you were doing.
But possibly, but I think he made the point to me, which is I think a very legitimate point, especially in the last couple of years, where you know we're not able to go into physical spaces so much. People have been scammed more easily by people persuading them to put details or connect accounts or transfer things directly. Without really necessarily understanding what they were doing. So, I found that an interesting sidebar to this conversation. I think cryptography, cryptocurrency, blockchain are things that have happened and I'm aware of and I'm familiar with to an extent, but they're not things I'm an expert in. And I personally feel a little... I kind of regret that I haven't spent as much time as I could have done with them so far.
Cool. Well, it's interesting when you talk about the web monetization project. I remember, gosh, I don't even remember how many years ago it was, but it's been at least 5 years, maybe longer. I set up a Flattr account.
Oh, that was a long time ago. Right? Yeah, I mean, that must be 10 or 15 years, surely.
Yeah. To connect up to, I think one of my blogs is to see what monetization could occur, you know, and on my personal blog, I've enabled some Google AdWords, right? Not Google AdWords, but Google Ads. And I think I've almost paid enough, made enough to buy a stick of bubblegum, right?
2010 Flattr launch. Yeah. It's a Swedish company.
God, that's been a while.
Yeah, well, throw that through the Wikipedia article for that in the show notes in case people want to go and reminisce.
Reminisce on trying to monetize a website, but it was kind of like almost like a Patreon type model.
Micropayments, micropayments, and so that's absolutely where web monetization is now. But it's backed by secure wallets, so it's really interesting. I find. I'm really interested in the Wired article that led us to this story, or that we started talking about about Web3 and really just sort of trying to maintain web freedom through these technologies.
Well, it's interesting because when we really look at the majority of the users on the web, and I'm grossly oversimplifying this, think of the web as a free space, right? And that all these services should be free. And we've gone into this and, you know, it's free because you're paying with your data, right? And when you look at web monetization in a way to where you're actually paying for things that you use by paying for them, right? I think it's weird that that almost becomes the anti-model. That's, you know, that's the new thing that might take off, right? Of actually paying for the services you use, paying for the online articles that you read, etc., and the amount of pushback and concern that comes up around these ideas, it just kind of flips me out. Because, you know, I remember, I'll use a phrase that some of our listeners may know. I used to write shareware.
Ah, yes.
and because I was running a bulletin board, and that was on modem, right? And so the idea was you would put your software out there for free, with the say, you know, but if you use it, give me some money, right? Help me keep maintaining it, and it's just interesting kind of the waves of software is free, which if you go way back to the beginning of computing, right, the hardware was expensive, and as part of the hardware you got services to write the software. And then software became the big thing, and then the services, then the cloud, etc. So it's interesting to see the whole web monetization effort going on, and see how that's gonna go forward. Well, I know we're just about out of time, and we had a couple other really interesting things we wanted to hit on real quick. The first being this unbelievable robot that does very human-like expression. You and I both spent some time before we kicked off the show today looking at the video, and I was blown away.
Yeah, this is a firm in the UK, in the far, actually in Cornwall, which is the west, the, if you think of the UK, it's kind of the western sort of foot, down, way down on the end there. So that's interesting in itself, because that's not typically always been an area that's been known for technology companies, but this is an organization, a robotics company called Engineered Arts, and an incredible video of, or several videos of the, this particular robot called Amica or Amica. I think they're going to show it off more at CES in January. Facial expressions and hand expressions, really shockingly amazing. Reminds me very much of the Will Smith iRobot movie.
Exactly. I was saying the body frame of the robot,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
I mean, but it's this, just, wow.
It does also point out that it can't walk at this time, you know, so they just need to combine this with one of the Alphabet company's robotic dog horse things.
Boston Robotics?
Yeah, Boston Robotics, exactly.
But
interesting stuff. I've seen tweets about this ranging from this is incredible to we're doomed. If you combine
The funny thing is, the funny thing is, if you think about this as, you know, our robot overloads are going to destroy us all, you know what they need? They need a missile silo.
So
if they had a missile silo,
who's they?
They could create a keyboard. The robots.
Oh, I thought you were talking about us keeping the keyboard to destroy them.
No.
You've just gave the farm away, Michael. You've literally just given the planet to the robots. Lucky Matrix Resurrections doesn't come out in a couple of weeks or anything to terrify us.
And I'm looking forward to be terrified.
So this is a story from Hackaday, which is one of my favorite blogs right now. Hackaday and Hackday.io, Hackster.io, I'm sorry. They're two separate sites, but they're just all about people hacking on different hardware things. And this is somebody who got hold of a military-grade keyboard and trackball that potentially has been used in something like a nuclear bunker. You know, it was an eBay auction. They went for it, and they've managed to convert it to use USB.
I bet you it has a great sound to it, clackety, clackety, clackety when you're typing on it.
They've managed to put this thing into use an Arduino to make this thing into something that you can use. It reminds me somewhat of the Commodore 64 that a friend of mine from work gave me a few years ago, gifted me, which has been converted to be a USB keyboard on a modern computer. Although it can also be can still be used as Commodore 64, but there's a little board that you can get, which I got, that enables me to use it as a USB keyboard. It's a terrible, terrible keyboard now, as it was then, it's a fun thing. But this looks really
cool.
But
you can smash those keys with almost a bit, you know, total abandonment.
Problem is that these days you require a lot more from a keyboard than you used to. So, you know, things like command and option keys didn't exist.
I was trying to remember, if I remember, the 64 had four keys that were your function keys.
Right, and then it had like weird icons on the front side of the key as well.
Yes.
That you had to like press certain combinations to get those characters, which obviously no longer exist as actual printable character, all that sort of stuff. So
well, speaking of no longer existing, I think this is kind of our time for the show no longer exists.
This episode. Just to be clear, this episode, I was about to say, Michael, you can't just like blink us out of existence. having given the world to the robots, you can't just go, that's it.
Snap my fingers with the Infinity Gauntlet. We do want to thank everybody for reaching out over the last week. We know at least in the U.S. it was a holiday week last week, and that slowed down a little bit the feedback. But we keep getting the feedback, and we appreciate it. We really look forward to getting your tweets. Your comments on the site are always welcomed. And, a review or a rating on any of your favorite podcatching sites would be greatly appreciated. Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, the Blueberry Network itself, any of those podcast places, give us a rating. We'd love to hear from you, and we would appreciate it.
And we will let you hear our voices next time.
At gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.